Well, it's wonderful to be here. It's a beautiful Sabbath day today. Wonderful to be here with God's people and have a place to meet. It's kind of frustrating, you know, having to flip-flop sometimes, but, you know, we're sojourners, we're pilgrims. We're still, you know, we still aren't settled all the time. So that's kind of our normal. Now let's turn to Judges chapter 13. And we see in the nation of Israel a time period of drought, of famine. There are times of peace that were during this period that we're going to be reading about. There are also times of war, of battles. And the people were often afraid of the armies of their enemies that surrounded them. Yet this fear was not enough to turn them back to God. I better find Judges. You guys are already there. Judges chapter 13. I found Judges. There it is. Okay, good. Verse 1, it says, "Again, the children of Israel did evil in the sight of the Lord." So this is not anything new up to this point. "And the Lord delivered them into the hand of the Philistines for 40 years. So we see a little bit of history being written down here. And we see a little bit of the state of the people. And we get a sense of what's going on. Now the nation, at this point, of course, they have to wait for their deliverance that they figured would probably come. I mean, God had always come and saved them before, even though they kept turning away from Him. Even the leaders of the country turned away from God. All the people as well, or most of the people. There's always a few people around who are always faithful. But you know, we don't see that overall at this time period in Israel. But there was one family, we're going to read a little bit of their story. A husband and a wife from the tribe of Dan. They worked quietly, and they wondered what would be happening next for them. In their future. Up to this point, they had no children to pass their inheritance onto. They worked faithfully, and they knew that God existed. They prayed to Him, but that was about it. They had no sons to take the inheritance, no daughters to marry off to anyone. And would their efforts be good enough for God to reach out to save them? And they wondered these things to themselves. Had God forgotten them? Had God left them alone because they had forgotten His ways? Now one day, the husband, Manoah, we'll read about him in this chapter, he was out working. And his wife as well, she was out working. And the angel of the Lord appeared to his wife. His wife ran and grabbed him. And told him everything that the angel of the Lord had told her. The promises of a deliverer through a child that she would bear. Verse 4. "Now therefore, please be careful." Here are the instructions that she is given about how she is supposed to live from this point forward as she prepares for this child to be born. "Now therefore, please be careful not to drink wine or similar drink and not to eat anything unclean." So she's given some specific instructions here on how to live her life. Verse 5, "For behold, you shall conceive and bear a son, and no razor shall come upon his head, for the child shall be a Nazarite to God from the womb. And he shall begin to deliver Israel out of the hand of the Philistines." So the child that she would bear would be a deliverer of the people of God. Now the woman ran and told her husband about this conversation, and she didn't yet understand who she was talking to. She didn't know that this was the angel of the Lord. She didn't know that this was the word of God, the Son of God, who spoke to her and gave her that hope that day. She knew he was not just some regular man. He looked different. We see that description in here. Now she stood before God that day and received special instructions on how to keep herself, how to set herself apart for the sake of this child who she would provide for this child who would be set apart for a special purpose, for the sake of this deliverer who God would raise up for his people. And Manoah, he listened to his wife and he prayed to God. And he asked God to come back to give them more instruction. He was so unsure. How do I raise this child? I want to make sure that I'm doing it the right way. This is obviously important. And so he does the right thing in this instance. He goes to God instead of trying to, make up the rules as he goes. Although, I've heard parenting is sometimes like that. You kind of make up the rules as you go, as best as you can from what you understood. You can ask all the parents in here. There are moments like that, I'm sure. I can't speak for myself, but I've talked to small children a lot in my life, and sometimes you kind of have to go with it. Now, God heard this man, Manoah, and we're going to read the words that God came and said to this man. Of course, first he came to his wife again. Verse 9, and the Lord listened to the voice of Manoah, and the angel of the Lord came to the woman again as she was sitting in the field. But Manoah, her husband, was not with her. Then the woman ran in haste and told her husband and said to him, look, the man who came to me the other day has just now appeared to me. He's back. This is significant. He's coming back. He's giving me some more instructions here. Now this time, God stayed a while. And Manoah came and talked to him as well. And we see in this instance, this husband and wife, they want to be involved in raising this child. We know that raising a child is a family effort. It's, there's that saying, it takes a village to raise a child. Well, it typically, if possible, it takes both a mother and a father. That's the ideal. But it takes, it's a team effort to raise children. That's the way that God designed the family structure. That's the ideal. And we see in this particular family two people who want to seek God's guidance in raising their offspring rather than trying to do things on their own. Now, I'm sure this was a little bit unique in their time, in this place, this time period where most of the people didn't pray to God. Most of the people didn't follow God's laws, God's way of life. And here this couple begins at this point to do that, to listen to the words of God. Let's continue on here. Verse 11. So Manoah arose and followed his wife. When he came to the man, he said to him, are you the man who spoke to this woman? And he said, I am. And Manoah said, now let your words come to pass. What will be the boy's rule of life and his work? And at this point, maybe he's thinking, maybe my son's going to be a prophet of God. And he's hoping that this man that he sees before him, who we know is more than just a man, maybe he's hoping he'll tell him, oh, he's going to be an amazing prophet, he's going to go and do this and do that. Well, that's not quite the case here. But he was going to be somebody set apart for a special purpose. And so he asks, what's going to be the work of this child that you are going to bring us, to give us? Verse 13, so the angel of the Lord said to Manoah, of all that I said to the woman, let her be careful. God is emphasizing to these people, this is how you have to do this. You have to do it the right way. You have to live this way so that this child will be ready, and so that you can teach your child how to live. Verse 14, he reemphasizes here the instruction, she may not eat anything that comes from the vine, nor may she drink wine or similar drink, nor eat anything unclean. All that I commanded her, let her observe. Let her do this so that she's ready to raise up this child the same way. Now we're going to continue reading here a little bit so that we see some evidence of who they're talking about and this realization that they come to. It's not just a man who they're speaking with here. Verse 15, then Manoah said to the angel of the Lord, please let us detain you and we will prepare a young goat for you. And the angel of the Lord said to Manoah, though you detain me, I will not eat your food. But if you offer a burnt offering, you must offer it to the Lord. For Manoah did not know he was the angel of the Lord. Then Manoah said to the angel of the Lord, what is your name, that when your words come to pass, we may honor you? And the angel of the Lord said to him, "Why do you ask my name, seeing it is wonderful?" That's one of those clues there that this isn't just an angel. The angels wouldn't, you know, an angel would have said, "Well, don't worship me," you know, when these words come to pass. But here he doesn't say that. He just says, "Well, why do I have to give you my name? You should already know my name. You are my people." Verse 19, "So Manoah took the young goat with the grain offering and offered it upon the rock to the Lord. And he did a wondrous thing while Manoah and his wife looked on. And it happened," in verse 20, "as the flame went up toward heaven from the altar, the angel of the Lord ascended in the flame of the altar. When Manoah and his wife saw this, they fell on their faces to the ground." And they began to worship God there. "When the angel of the Lord appeared no more to Manoah and his wife, then Manoah knew that he was the angel," or the messenger, "of the Lord. And Manoah said to his wife, 'We shall surely die because we have seen God.'" Here's that realization. This is God who stood before us. We've seen God. "But his wife said to him, 'If the Lord had desired to kill us, he would not have accepted a burnt offering and a grain offering from our hands. Nor would he have shown us all these things, nor would he have told us such things as these at this time.'" So there they have this, finally, a realization of who they were talking to. They're talking to God. And their lives at this point began to change. They had to start living a different way of life. They had to change the kind of foods that they ate, how they went about things. It would have been different, and it would have stood out to those who are around them, at least to a certain degree. And we don't have all the details, and we don't even know if Manoah himself had to follow these instructions or did follow these. I mean, I'm kind of assuming that he would. Now, we don't know who the cook of the family was. I'm assuming it was probably the wife. And she probably, you know, she couldn't eat grapes, so she probably wouldn't serve her husband grapes. We don't even know if they had grapes. I don't know. Probably not at this point forward. But they had to change how they lived. They had to take on these conditions of a special vow, at least for the wife, at least until her child was born. But probably after that too, because she would have to teach this child how he was supposed to live for the rest of his life. Now, we're talking about the Nazarite vow here. The Nazarite vow, it's not just some simple promise for everybody to make. It's not something that God says that, well, everybody has to do this. But it is a difficult vow, a difficult promise, a serious promise before God, which a person has to commit themselves to for a certain period of time if they choose to. And we're going to turn to Numbers chapter 6 and look at some of these instructions here. The instructions were given to people who might choose for a time to set themselves apart, to separate themselves in a unique way for a period of time, a limited period of time, however long that would be. It's not specified here. And they set aside a specific time with the purpose of drawing close to God, taking that time that they would otherwise spend doing other things, maybe pursuing some other, who knows, whatever activity, but taking extra time to set aside to draw close to God, to focus themselves, their attitude, change how they were living for a period of time. And we can think of it kind of like, you know, when we take a day to fast outside of the Day of Atonement. We take not a commanded time, but a time that would be our own, and we set it aside for a time period. And we go without for a while so that we can draw close to God. It's a way of refocusing our mind by giving something up that might be otherwise a distraction to us. Food can sometimes be a distraction to us, even though we have to have it every day. Well, technically we don't. But we usually have it every day. Now, the Nazarite vow is similar, but it's only for a specified time period. We don't really know. It doesn't really say. Now, let's read some of the details here. Verse 1 of chapter 6 in Numbers. The Lord spoke to Moses, verse 1 it says, saying, "Speak to the children of Israel and say to them, when either a man or woman consecrates an offering to the vow of a Nazarite, to separate himself to the Lord." So that's the purpose of it, to separate themselves to the Lord. And there are certain offerings, sacrifices that were to accompany this vow. "He shall separate himself from wine and similar drink. He shall drink neither vinegar made from wine nor vinegar made from similar drink. Neither shall he drink any grape juice nor eat fresh grapes or raisins." So stay away from anything that has to do with grapes whatsoever. And, you know, we don't know exactly why. That's probably a whole study on its own. Why did God say for this vow you have to do without grapes? There's probably a reason for that. I haven't studied that enough to be able to even speculate about that. Verse 4. "All the days of his separation he shall eat nothing that is produced by the grapevine from seed to skin. All the days of the vow of his separation no razor shall come upon his head until the days are fulfilled for which he separated himself to the Lord. He shall be holy." The word holy has to do with being set apart for something special. We'll get into that more later. So he's to be holy. I lost my place here. Was that? That was verse 5. "Then he shall let the locks of the hair of his head grow. All the days," in verse 6, "that he separates himself to the Lord, he shall not go near a dead body." So it's another condition here. He's not supposed to go near a dead body, because then he would be ceremonially unclean. And this, with this purpose, if he did that, his vow would be over. Verse 7, and this is very strict, this is a serious thing. Verse 7, "He shall not make himself unclean even for his father or his mother." So it didn't matter who it was. If a close relative died, he couldn't go and take care of the body to prepare it for burial, unless he was ready for that vow to be finished. It says, "For his brother or sister, when they die, because his separation to God is on his head." He's chosen this time to be separated to God. "All the days of his separation, he shall be holy to the Lord." And we have a few examples in the New Testament of people who took this vow. One in particular is very similar to this child that we're going to be reading about. You guys probably already figured out the child's name. John the Baptist was one who was under, it seems, a similar vow. We have some details. Let's turn to Luke chapter 1, verse 15. And we see that John the Baptist, or sometimes he's called John the Baptizer, he's not a Baptist the way that we think of it these days, but he was set apart for a special purpose even from before he was born, even from before he was conceived. Luke 1 verse 15, "For he will be great in the sight of the Lord, and shall drink neither wine nor strong drink." So we have these details that are very similar to this Nazarite vow. So it doesn't say that he was under this specific vow, but at least this detail is the same. "He will also be filled with the Holy Spirit even from his mother's womb." So he had a special purpose, and he was under a special vow. Matthew 11 verse 18, you can put this one in your notes. This is where Jesus describes how people saw John. It says in Matthew 11, 18, "For John came neither eating nor drinking, and they say he has a demon." Well, then they said about Jesus, "Well, he's a wine bibber. He feasts too much." They were never happy. But this gives us a detail into John's life. It was known that he didn't drink any alcohol. He was under a specific vow. Now in Acts chapter 18, let's turn over to Acts chapter 18. And we see that Paul the Apostle, he took this vow. At least it seems that this is probably the vow that he took for a period of time. So it wasn't an uncommon thing. It was something that God's people had known if they had read the scriptures. Acts 18, verse 18, it says, so this is when Paul is traveling from Corinth to Antioch. traveling around, seeing the people, preaching the word. So Paul still, in verse 18, remained a good while. Then he took leave of the brethren and sailed for Syria. And Priscilla and Aquila were with him. He had his hair cut off at Cenchrea, for he had taken a vow. So he took a vow, and it was more than likely the Nazarite vow. And he had to cut his hair when the vow was over. Now if we turn over to chapter 21, we see another group of individuals who were, you know, they were learning about the truth, and they were trying to understand who Paul was, what kind of man he was, as they were being called, and they had taken this vow as well. Acts 21, verse 23, it says, "Therefore, do what we tell you. We have four men who have taken a vow. Take them and be purified with them and pay their expenses so that they may shave their heads." So they didn't have enough money to be able to buy those the animals for the sacrifices, it kind of seems like here. And so they were going to pay their way so that they could finally be done with this vow and shave their heads and get on with life. "And that all may know that those things of which they were informed concerning you are nothing, but that you yourself also walk orderly and keep the law." Now this is referring to Paul here. There are people that said, well, he's teaching people that they don't have to keep the law of God anymore. After they met him and they actually talked to him, they figured out that, oh, he is teaching people to keep the law. Just not, you know, the law of circumcision. They bring that up in this chapter. And one detail that was not included in the Nazarite vow, but was mentioned specifically to Manoah and his wife. It's a very important detail. It was a clear instruction not to eat anything unclean. This is clearly not part of the Nazarite vow. Now, a person taking that vow would have already been following that instruction. That would have already been part of their life. Taking the other parts, following the other elements of that vow would have been different. It would have been something special. But these people hadn't been doing that up to this point, it seems. They needed that specific instruction to be reminded that they are God's special people, who he had set apart holy for his purposes, for a holy purpose. And that's one reason why they probably stood out at that time. Let's turn to Leviticus chapter 11 now. We can read these instructions to all of God's people that they are supposed to set themselves apart in this way for God's purposes, to demonstrate to themselves and to other people that they are God's people. And we follow this instruction as well. Anyone who is called, even to this day, to be God's people, we're set aside for a special purpose, apart from the world. Leviticus 11, verse 44, it says, "For I am the Lord your God. You shall therefore consecrate yourselves." Set yourselves aside, apart, set yourselves apart, "and you shall be holy, for I am holy. Neither shall you defile yourselves with any creeping thing that creeps on the earth." He's talking about, you know, all the insects, and he just went through a list of all the different animals that are unclean. Don't eat these things because they don't set you apart. You're to be God's people, set apart for a special purpose. Verse 45, "For I am the Lord who brings you up out of the land of Egypt to be your God. You shall therefore be holy, for I am holy. This is the law of the animals and the birds and every living creature that moves in the waters and of every creature that creeps on the earth, to distinguish between the unclean and the clean," in verse 47, "and between the animal that may be eaten and the animal that may not be eaten." So we have these clear instructions. At least at that time it was clear. Sometimes today people still argue about, well, what about this animal? What about that one? You know, there's some fish somewhere that has scales when it's a baby and it loses those scales. So is that fish unclean or clean? That's debated. We're not going to get into that today. And we see this continuity, though, through the Bible. Let's turn to Isaiah chapter 66, although this passage is in the Old Testament. It's a prophecy of a future time. And we see even at the time of the end, God looks out at the people of the world, and he's looking to see who has accepted that calling to be my people. Who has separated themselves apart from the world, the ways of the world, for my purposes. Isaiah 66. This comes down to a choice to obey God. And this verse brings out the fact that the choice to disobey God, even this, what might seem like a small command, something insignificant, is the same as worshiping idols, choosing to worship other gods. Isaiah 66, verse 15. For behold, the Lord will come with fire. This is talking about a future time of judgment on the earth. And with his chariots like a whirlwind, to render his anger with fury, and his rebuke with flames of fire. Verse 16, for by fire and by his sword the Lord will judge all flesh, and the slain of the Lord shall be many. It's a time of great judgment on the earth. And we see that the majority of the people of this world, even now, don't follow the ways of God. Verse 17 says, those who sanctify themselves and purify themselves to go to the gardens. So not to go to God, but to go to these other places that they see as special, as spiritual. After an idol in the midst, eating swine's flesh and the abomination and the mouse shall be consumed together, says the Lord. That doesn't mean we should eat pigs and mice together. That's not what that's talking about. But those who turn away from God, there's going to be a time of judgment. And those of this world will be consumed by this fire. And it brings out here two unclean animals that in some places are very common to eat. It might have been the case that in Israel, people were eating swine. They were eating pigs because it was more available, easier, more hardy of an animal to raise. And mice because they're so plentiful. Oh, I can't handle that. I've never seen anybody eat a mouse, thankfully. We saw a few people sell them on the side of the road in Malawi. We got a picture. Lena has a great picture of some mice kebabs of sorts. But we never ate them. And definitely didn't eat them. Definitely not. And we never saw anybody else eat them. But we didn't buy them either. We did pay a young man so that we could take a picture of his mice. That was it. And we left. We're hoping that he just, you know, left after that. But we see this, you know, this choice that some people make and will make to disobey even something that people might see as insignificant. But God sees it as important, even these small things. And when we choose to follow God's ways, his laws, his commands, and specifically we're talking about this, you know, the command of, or the law of clean and unclean meats, choosing to follow God in that, we're choosing to align ourselves with God. We're choosing to acknowledge the fact that God knows better than we do how we're supposed to live. We're acknowledging that he is the one who created all things. We're acknowledging that he knows best about everything in our lives, even the small details. And it's more than just about physical health. There have been all kinds of studies that have gone into, you know, the effects of eating certain meats in your life. God doesn't go into those details in Scripture because that's not the point of it. It's more about our spiritual health, our connection with God, and acknowledging that he has set us apart for something special. When we choose to follow that simple command, we acknowledge that fact, that it means something. We mean something to God. And he has something amazing for us to do. An amazing purpose. It's an outward action on our part that is supposed to demonstrate that inward submission to God, to his authority in our life. Now, in the Old and New Testament, it uses the word holy. In the Old Testament, in many places, the word that's translated holy in the Hebrew is kadosh. You can look up the spelling later. It's spelled different ways. Kadosh. It can mean pure, clean, free from defilement of crimes, idolatry, and other unclean and profane things. This is from the Blue Letter Bible, who takes it from the let's see if I can pronounce this name, Jacinius, that's the guy's name. Jacinius's Hebrew Chaldee Lexicon. I need to read more Greek and Hebrew and all this. So this word kadosh can also mean something that let me see if I can find my spot here. Well, continues on here. It says, in fixing the proper notion of this word, the classical passage of Leviticus 11, verse 43, it says, where after the law of respecting unclean meats, which were to be abstained from, it is said, you shall not pollute yourselves with these things, lest you make yourselves unclean. So it's a reference to the Bible there. But so this word can be pure, clean, free from defilement of crimes. And so it's a word that God uses to describe his people after we've been washed clean of our crimes against him, our sins. Now in the Greek, this word is hagios. It's a few different definitions of hagios. It could mean properly reverend, worthy of veneration. Now that's not how we're supposed to describe ourselves. We describe God that way. God is holy, but we are supposed to be like him. Continues on here with Thayer's Greek lexicon. It says, of things which on account of some connection with God possess a certain distinction and claim to reverence, as places sacred to God which are not to be profaned, of persons whose services God employs. So God has special purposes for people. Set apart for God. This is another definition. Set apart for God to be, as it were, exclusively his. When we are considered holy by God, we are considered to be exclusively his. It goes on to describe sacrifices and offerings prepared for God with solemn rite, pure and clean, and lastly, in a moral sense, pure, sinless, upright, holy. So this is this concept that we're talking about, holy, set apart, exclusively God's. Somebody who God calls to be in his service for his purposes. Let's turn back to Judges. Chapter 13. Judges chapter 13. We'll pick up where we left off. We finally get to see who this child is. Verse 24, Judges 13. So the woman bore a son and called his name Samson. And the child grew, and the Lord blessed him. And we can assume at this point that the couple raised Samson the right way, the way that they were supposed to, the way that they were told by God to do. That they taught him, you're going to be different. You have to live this different way of life. You're going to stand out from your peers, from the other kids that you might see, from your brothers and sisters. We don't know if they had other children. It doesn't sound like it. If they did, he would stand out from his brothers and sisters as well. And we see that God began to work with this child, even from that time. Verse 25, and the Spirit of the Lord began to move upon him at Mahanadan, between Zorah and Eshtaol. I was looking at a map of the region. This is sort of in the middle of the country of Israel, maybe near the border of where there was northern Israel and Judah in the south, somewhere in the middle. So we see this individual who God had called out for a special purpose, to be set apart for doing God's work. Now, we don't get all the details of Samson growing up. It would have been interesting to hear some of the stories of his childhood. But we do see, you know, some of the end results. And we see, as often happens with people who get, you know, they receive some kind of special gift, some kind of ability, pride creeps in. Pride happens to people. This happens to all of us. So pride crept in to Samson's mind. And he began to believe that his blessings from God, his strength that God had given him, came from within himself. He'd forgotten that he was set aside for a special purpose. Now in Judges 14, we're not going to read the whole story here, but we do see this first time where it seems that Samson, or at least we're told, that Samson begins to disregard his special vow. Now Samson didn't choose this vow, but he had to the chance to choose to continue this vow for the rest of his life. This is what he was being asked to do. And we see him begin to disregard this vow. Verse 5. So Samson went down to Timnah with his father and mother and came to the vineyards of Timnah. Now he's going out to find a wife, and he chooses a woman from the Philistines because he can't find a wife among his people. Of course, his parents didn't yet know that this was God working things out. We're told that earlier in the chapter. Now, to his surprise, a young lion came roaring against him. Now, this very well could have been the first time that Samson experienced something like this. Maybe the first time that he saw this great strength in himself. We don't know. This is the first time we're hearing about it. He doesn't tell anybody about it. And the Spirit of the Lord came mightily upon him. Sounds like he was out by himself. And he tore the lion apart as one who would have torn apart a young goat. I don't know anybody who's torn apart a young goat, but it's relatively easy to tearing apart a lion. We get the sense there. Though he had nothing in his hand, it says. But he did not tell his father or his mother what he had done. He kept it a secret. So then he sees his own strength. If this was the first instance of anything like this, he sees his own strength for the first time. Now then he went down and talked with the woman, and she pleased Samson well. Figured he found a wife. And after some time, now this is where we get into where he seems to start disregarding his vow. He doesn't see himself as something set apart, but as something that, you know, he can kind of do what he wants. When he returned to get her, he turned aside to see the carcass of the lion. And behold, a swarm of bees and honey were in the carcass of the lion. So we're not even dealing with grapes here. We're dealing with this unclean animal, the body of this unclean animal. And he doesn't actually eat the flesh of the animal, but he does take food from the carcass of this beast that's there, the dead animal that he had killed. In verse 9, he took some of it in his hands and went along eating. When he came to his father and mother, he gave some to them, and they also ate. But he did not tell them that he had taken the honey out of the carcass of the lion. Now, I'd venture a guess that eating honey from a dead, unclean animal's body is probably not something that God intended for Samson to do. And he also feeds it to his parents. His mother was also living this way of life. They both received this word to not eat from unclean animals. And here this is, you know, a disregarding of any kind of instruction from God that we see from Samson. And he doesn't tell anybody else about it. He's not worried about it. He's not trying to figure it out for himself. You know, is this the right thing to do? He just disregards it and moves on. Well, from this point forward, we see Samson become more and more arrogant. We see him looking at himself as somebody powerful rather than looking to God who gave him his strength. And he forgets that it was God who gave him that strength to do the amazing things that he did and he would continue to do. Now God would give him that strength until that vow had been broken. Now we see that there was one part in particular that, you know, that he broke, that was more obvious, probably the most obvious part of his vow. He hadn't cut his hair from the time he was born. Probably had pretty long hair. I don't know if he had it braided or anything like that. I have no idea. Maybe he had dreadlocks at that point. We don't know how old he was. Probably 20 years old, I think. That's just my estimations. And so we see this young man becoming more and more arrogant. And his strength, God is still giving him this strength because he hasn't broken all the parts of the vow. But he hasn't kept himself clean. He hasn't kept himself holy. He hasn't set himself apart. He hasn't committed his life to God and the work that God has called him to. Now let's continue on here and let's go to chapter 16. We see here where this arrogance really comes out. And he breaks this vow. He lets it be known how his strength can be taken from him. And we know this story, but let's read it. In verse 1 of chapter 16, it says, "Now Samson went to Gaza and saw a harlot there, and went into her." Well, that's a whole different sin there. So he's already not, you know, he doesn't seem to care how he lives, and he doesn't seem to care that God would not see this as the action of somebody who's holy. Verse 2, when the Gazites were told, Samson has come here, they surrounded the place and lay in wait for him all night at the gate of the city. They were quiet all night, saying, in the morning, when it is daylight, we will kill him. And Samson lay low till midnight. Then he arose at midnight, took hold of the doors of the gate of the city and the two gate posts, pulled them up, bar and all, put them on his shoulders, and carried them to the top of the hill that faces Hebron. So he's doing this incredible feat. You know, and he's probably, his adrenaline is going. He's excited. He's thinking, nothing can touch me. Look what I did. These city gates, they're not just some, you know, measly gates that you see on a fence. These things are huge. They're heavy, thick wood and metal, whatever else they're constructed of. And he just picks them up like they're nothing and carries them away. In verse 4, afterward it happened that he loved a woman in the valley of Sorek, whose name was Delilah. So he falls in love. And he's just enamored by this woman. He'll do anything for her. And the lords of the Philistines came up to her and said to her, entice him and find out where his great strength lies, and by what means we may overpower him, that we may bind him to afflict him. And every one of us will give you 1,100 pieces of silver. So they bribe her with money. And she's, you know, it seems like she doesn't, you know, she doesn't care for Samson that much. She's like, well, okay, all right. I'll spend some time with him because you guys are giving me some money because he kind of likes me. Verse 6, so Delilah said to Samson, please tell me where your great strength lies and with what you may be bound to afflict you. It should have been obvious at this point that she was, you know, working some schemes trying to get him. But he was too enamored. Plus, he probably thought that his strength was too powerful for anybody to take. And he thought that he was invincible. Verse 15, we're not going to read through this whole story, all the details, but he, you know, up to this point, he tells her a few things that aren't true, and he breaks free, and she keeps trying, and he still doesn't get it. And verse 15, then she said to him, how can you say I love you when your heart is not with me? Ooh, that really gets a young man there who's in love. How can you say that you love me and you don't do this for me, you don't do that? You have mocked me these three times and have not told me where your great strength lies. And he's really thinking about it this time. And he's probably thinking, well, I might as well tell her. It doesn't really matter. God's still going to give me strength. He hasn't taken away my strength up to this point. Maybe he's thinking about all the things that he did that might have broken his vow, or that he knew were against the commands of God. The fact that he didn't have that commitment to God. Who knows? And it came to pass, when she pestered him daily with her words and pressed him so that his soul was vexed to death, that he told her all his heart and said to her, no razor has ever come upon my head, for I have been a Nazarite to God from my mother's womb. So it wasn't a secret vow, but he betrays the vow here at this point. He completely gives it up. He says, I'm under a vow. I haven't cut my hair. If I am shaven, then my strength will leave me, and I shall become weak and be like any other man. As he's saying these words, it's obvious that he doesn't really believe these things. Either that, or he loves this woman so much that he's willing to give up his strength. But he doesn't care about his commitment to God. He doesn't care about keeping himself from unclean things. He doesn't set himself apart as somebody who is special to God for God's special purposes. He breaks his vow here. Well, he allows somebody else to break his vow for him. Now, Samson, he gives up that designation as set apart. And the Philistines, they take him, they bind him, and they put out his eyes. In verse 21, the Philistines took him and put out his eyes and brought him down to Gaza. They bound him with bronze fetters, and he became a grinder in the prison. So he hadn't completely lost all strength. He just lost his superhuman strength. They could still put him to work. In verse 22, It says, however, the hair of his head began to grow again after it had been shaven. Now, it wasn't that it was magical hair or anything. It was because of this commitment to God through this vow of setting himself apart as somebody holy, somebody who has been chosen by God for a special purpose. It's this connection here that allows him to receive that strength from God. So we see this hair starting to grow up, or to grow out, but it's not until Samson acknowledges God's part in this that he gains his strength back. He starts acknowledging that God has set him apart as something special. In verse 23, now the lords of the Philistines gathered together to offer a great sacrifice to Dagon, their god, and to rejoice. And they said, our God has delivered into our hands Samson, our enemy. And when the people saw him, they praised their God, for they said, our God has delivered into our hands our enemy, the destroyer of our land, and the one who multiplied our dead. Now they're extremely happy. And Samson is probably, he's blind. He's feeling very down about himself. He's realizing that the strength doesn't come from him, obviously. It's nothing that he did. In verse 25, so it happened when their hearts were merry that they said, call for Samson. And they're thinking, well, let's mock him some more. Let's bring him out that he may perform for us. So they called for Samson from the prison, and he performed for them. And they stationed him between the pillars. Now here, this is where we see that Samson finally realizes something. He finally realizes that he doesn't belong to himself. He wasn't doing his own work. And God has placed him in this place at this particular time, again, to do his work. He acknowledges God, it seems, for the very first time here, right before his death. In verse 26, then Samson said to the lad who held him by the hand, let me feel the pillars which support the temple so that I can lean on them. Now the temple was full of men and women. All the lords of the Philistines were there, about 3,000 men and women on the roof watching while Samson performed. All these very important people of the nation of the Philistines who were against God, against God's people, their enemies, all in one place. Not by coincidence. And not by coincidence with Samson there as well. Verse 28. Then Samson called to the Lord. So here we have Samson finally acknowledging God. He called to the Lord saying, O Lord God, remember me, I pray. Strengthen me, I pray. Just this once, O God, that I may with one blow take vengeance on the Philistines for my two eyes. And Samson took hold of the two middle pillars which supported the temple, and he braced himself against them, one on his right and the other on his left. And Samson said, let me die with the Philistines. And he pushed with all his might, and the temple fell on the lords and all the people who were in it. So the dead that he had killed at his death were more than he had killed in his life. Once he acknowledged God, finally, he was able to achieve God's purposes here. To take down a good amount here of the enemies of God's people. In verse 31, and his brothers and all his father's household came down and took him and brought him up and buried him between Zorah and Eshtaol in the tomb of his father, Manoah. He had judged Israel 20 years. So we see here that he was even given an honorable death or an honorable burial here by his family. God even allowed that. And we have to look at this story, and think, well, have I acknowledged God in my life? Have I acknowledged that God has set me apart? Have we set ourselves apart as God commands us to do? I'm probably preaching to the choir here. We're all here on God's Sabbath day, acknowledging that God has called us for a special purpose. Now, this is not just some vow that we take for just a short period of time. When we answer the calling from God, it's a lifelong vow. We don't vow to never cut our hair. I need a haircut right now. I haven't vowed not to cut it. I just haven't been to the barber recently. But we make this lifelong, serious commitment. We connect ourselves to God. There are exterior ways to do that, such as refraining from eating unclean meats. And there are ways that we do that on the inside. We have to have both. Let's turn to 1 Corinthians chapter 3. Keeping ourselves from unclean things, unclean meats in particular, is one aspect of this commitment to God, this way that we show God that we are committed to Him. Sometimes other people notice that, and they ask questions about that, and we're able to hopefully answer those questions. 1 Corinthians chapter 3, in verse 16, let's start with verse 16. It says, "Do you not know that you are the temple of God, and that the Spirit of God dwells in you?" God's Spirit, His power, His essence, a little bit of Him, dwells in us. We're special. If we've made that commitment to be special, to be holy, to set ourselves apart. "If anyone defiles the temple of God, God will destroy him, for the temple of God is holy." Which temple you are? We're God's dwelling place. Even our simple physical bodies have been set apart for a special purpose. 1 Corinthians 6 and verse 19 now. Verse 19 of chapter 6. It says, "Or do you not know that your body is the temple of the Holy Spirit who is in you, which is in you, whom you have from God, and you are not your own?" We are not our own. God has claimed us as His. He's purchased us with the blood of His Son. And that means we have to live a different way of life after we've answered that calling from God. "For you were bought at a price, therefore glorify God in your body and in your spirit, which are God's." Every part of us. Our minds have to be set apart. Our bodies have to be set apart. Our actions, our thoughts, everything that we say and do has to be set apart and holy. And when we accept this calling to be holy, we become servants of God. It's not just about, you know, being called for a future serving of God, but it's now in this time. Now James talks about that. James 1. James chapter 1. I think James is probably one of my favorite chapters, or one of my favorite books in the Bible. Has a lot of similar qualities to my other favorite book in the Bible, Ecclesiastes. You can set the two side by side and kind of read through a lot of the main points in there. Now James 1 in verse 27, it says, "Pure and undefiled religion." In other words, pure and undefiled way of worshiping God, a way of life. Religion is supposed to be a way of life and not just something that we do on the weekends. It says, "Pure and undefiled religion before God and the Father is this: to visit orphans and widows in their trouble, and to keep oneself unspotted from the world." In other words, you know, to go and to serve people, and to set yourself aside for God's purposes. To keep oneself unspotted from the world. Unspotted, you know, not just physically, but that's an element of it, but also spiritually. We give up our sins. We don't do things that God would disapprove of. We do things that God would approve of. We set ourselves apart for His purposes. Romans chapter 12. Romans chapter 12, the first few verses here, verse 1 and 2. Verse 1, it says, "I beseech you, therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God, that you present your bodies a living sacrifice, holy, acceptable to God, which is your reasonable service." It's not unreasonable when God calls us to do this. It becomes our way of life to set ourselves apart as a living sacrifice. We sacrifice our time. We sacrifice our efforts. We sacrifice, well, in some cases, even foods that are considered delicious by the rest of the world. We sacrifice those things as well. But we make a commitment to be servants of God. Verse 2, "And do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind." So there's this internal changing. an internal setting apart of our mind for God's purposes, that you may prove what is the good and acceptable and perfect will of God. Let's turn to a few more scriptures. 1 Peter chapter 1. God is trying to change our very nature to become like Him, to become holy as He is holy. 1 Peter chapter 1. Verse 13. It says, "Therefore, gird up the loins of your mind. Be sober. And rest your hope fully on the grace that is to be brought to you at the revelation of Jesus Christ. As obedient children, not conforming yourselves to the former lusts, as in your ignorance, but as He who called you is holy, you also be holy in all your conduct." So it's talking about our conduct. Our mind, changing the way that we think, affects how we live. And it should affect how we live. If it doesn't, then there's a disconnect there. It's not just knowledge for the sake of knowledge, but it has to be application of this knowledge. Verse 16, "Because it is written, be holy, for I am holy. And if you call on the Father who without partiality judges according to each one's work, conduct yourselves throughout the time of your stay here in fear." That's the good kind of fear. Honoring God, respecting Him, acknowledging that He is the one who has called us to be holy. Chapter 2, 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 9, it says, "But you are a chosen generation, a royal priesthood." So we get into a little bit of our purpose, our future purpose, and our present purpose. "A holy nation, His own special people, that you may proclaim the praises of Him who called you out of darkness into His marvelous light, who once were not a people, but are now the people of God, who had not obtained mercy, but now have obtained mercy." We take on the qualities of God's people by acting like His people, by thinking like His people, by maintaining that connection with God that we can't have if we aren't set apart, if we don't set ourselves apart as holy and acknowledge that God has called us to be holy. Maybe I'll give you a few more scriptures that you can look up on your own, some scriptures that we read pretty often in Revelation. Revelation 12, verse 17 describes God's people. When Jesus Christ returns to this earth, as He came and he spoke to Manoah and his wife, He's going to be looking out to see who is keeping His word. Revelation 12:17 describes God's people as those who keep His commandments and have the testimony of Jesus Christ. God will be looking for those people who have set themselves apart. Revelation 19, in several places, several verses, verse 8 and verse 14, talk about the saints being arrayed in fine linen, white, clean, which is the righteous acts of the saints. They're clean. They've set themselves apart through the way that they live. That connection with God, acknowledging that they are supposed to be holy. Verse 14 again reiterates this, people clothed in fine linen, white and clean. Revelation 20, verse 6, maybe we'll turn to that one, but Revelation 20, verse 6, This shows us that we are special for a special purpose, called to be part of a special resurrection, and we have a job to do, both now and in the future. Verse 6, Revelation 20, it says, "Blessed and holy is he who has part in the first resurrection. Over such the second death has no power, but they shall be priests of God and of Christ, and shall reign with him 1,000 years. The purposes that God has called us. As priests, we're called to teach people. Even now, we teach people, we instruct people how to live the ways of God. We preach the gospel to the world. And we have the chance in the millennium to reign with Christ as kings, alongside Him, alongside God. So God has some amazing purposes for us. And He calls us to set ourselves apart. And when we do that, when we acknowledge His authority, we acknowledge the fact that He is the one who gives us strength. We acknowledge the fact that it is Him who has called us to something special. And if we want to maintain that connection with Him, We have to set ourselves apart, even in the small ways. We make that lifelong commitment, that lifelong vow, like Samson was supposed to. A different, different vow, a little bit there. But we make a lifelong vow to God. And we begin now, setting ourselves apart as God's special people.